I'm a kind of house, you really have a little fun. Need me come back your bout, I got more than one. It's a good thing. It's a good thing. It's a good thing. I'm more than one woman. Now let me tell a little something, don't you really know, but most of these young women want to lose trust. Pull the egg from the ankle, from to the knee. Just pull the gun, damn minute they can be. While you out, man, trying to study some plan. She's winking and blinking at another man. You get out of sight, you're peeping through the crack. I wonder how long for the old man get back. A man get back, you ready to have a little fun. Boy, you get out of sight, you got more than one in a good man. Ain't a good thing, ain't a good thing. And I'm getting old on the head, getting gray. Lord, I'm not four-legged, but I walk that away. Claim to be the oldest rat of the barn. I know about the women long before God grown. Some in the daytime, some at night. Hide the word, teach you treating the slaving man right. The time to get out, you're ready to cramp your head. Turn around and slipping down, jumping in your own bed. You jump in your bed, you're getting to have a little fun. Next thing you want to know, got a little lunch done. A little lunch done from three to four. Talk it around before your old man go. You may be brown skin, your color may be black. What I say about these women, I won't take it back. I get drunk, love to have my fun. Most all the women got more than one in a good thing. And a good thing. And a good thing. Now more than one woman never do.
Well, that there was a song from the Beale Street Sheiks entitled It's a Good Thing. That's from a Yazoo collection called The Roots of Rap. And you can hear from the vocal stylings and tempo, the rhythm of that, Beale Street Sheiks were onto something. We also heard from Blind Willie Johnson, and that was Motherless Children Have a Hard Time, recorded in 1927, recorded by many others since then. Let's hear next from Muddy Waters, why don't we? Here he is with You're Gonna Miss Me When I'm Gone, Muddy Waters on the Deep Blues Hour.
Well, I'm gonna tell you, baby, no more tell you, low down. Thing or two, I just can't stand it, low down. Well, you do, but how you gonna miss me when I'm dead and gone? Well, you gonna miss me, baby, now. When I'm dead and gone. Well, you know I've been feeling blue, I've been feeling blue, baby. Baby, all day long. I've just been sitting out here thinking one word. Is it where you gone, but how you gonna miss me? When I'm dead and gone. Well, you gon' miss me, baby, now, when I'm dead and gone. Well, you know, I've been feeling blue, I've been feeling blue, baby, ever since the sun went down. I just been sitting here thinking, wondering why don't you drive in this town, but hey, you gonna miss me when I'm dead and gone. Well, you gon' miss me, baby, now, when I'm dead and gone. Well, I know you don't want me, I know you don't want me, guy, cause your best friend. Best friend told me so, but that's all right, gal, I can get a woman more. Anywhere I go, but hey, you gonna miss me when I'm dead and gone. Well, you know you're gonna miss me, baby, now, when I'm dead and gone. Yeah, man, you know she's gonna miss me. Well, now you know the blues was whiskey boy than I was a diving down. I would dive to the bottom, baby, never.
Hi, this is Kevin Amos, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, and it's time for this week's edition of In Black America and Ebony Spectrum.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
And so the problem for most people is they're working in these places and they think these jobs will never end. I start the job on day one already thinking it's going to end. So every place I was, so CNN, TV One, Tom Joyner Morning Show, going back to Chicago Defender, Dallas Weekly, going back to my first job, Austin American Statesman, my second job, Fort Worth Star-Telegram, that literally was the mindset. Always, because even in the places, even going back to Austin and Fort Worth, I bought my own stuff. So I owned my own laptop, had my own cell phone, had my own camera. So if anything happened to the job, I still had gear that I can then use to get paid.
Roland S. Martin, journalist, columnist, commentator, author, managing editor of Roland Martin Unfiltered, and founder of the Black Star Network. For two decades, Martin has been the conscience of Black America. In 2012, when Jet Magazine readers voted for Who's the King of the Hill in terms of who they turn to on issues of concern for African Americans, he came out on top, ahead of Reverend Al Sharpton and Donna Brazile. I first met Martin when he was a county government and neighbors reporter for the Austin American Statesman. He then went on to become morning drive reporter for KRLD 1080 AM in Dallas, news director and morning anchor at KKDA AM in Dallas, and city hall reporter for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Martin gained national notoriety when he spent 6 years as a contributor for CNN. Martin is one of the few working journalists that worked in every area of the industry, newspapers, radio, and television. Currently, he's the captain of his own ship as founder of the Black Star Network. I'm Johnny O'Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, Roland S. Martin, Unfiltered, In Black America.
We cannot be in a position where we are having to go ask white journalist to go talk to important black people because they don't know who's important in our community. So they go, well, no one knows who that is, so we're not interested. I wasn't gonna do that. And that was a driving motivation. And I said, I'm not asking permission. The history of black people, we don't get here because we waited on them. And this, and I've been saying this for now for more than two decades. My greatest fear is that when it comes to black news, not entertainment, not sports, my greatest fear, and if you look at how we've just fallen, Ebony and Jet and even Essence, and we're going on, we're going to be asking white media, if we're not careful, to tell our story.
Over the course of his journalistic career, Roland S. Martin has used his voice to speak truth to power. As a child growing up in Houston, Texas, Third Ward, his parents were his role models. At 14, he discovered his passion for communications while attending Jack Yates High School, a magnet school of communications. During his career so far, Martin has had many firsts. He was a founding news editor for Savoy Magazine and the founding editor of BlackAmericaWeb.com. And he launched the first black news source audio and video podcast in 2005 and 2006 at the Chicago Defender. Martin has received numerous awards for his work in multiple media platforms. He is a four-time NAACP Image Award winner, and in 2013 he was named Journalist of the Year by the National Association of Black Journalists. Martin is also the author of four books. His latest is White Fear, How the Browning of America is Making White Folks Lose Their Minds. In Black America spoke with him at the National Urban League Conference in Houston, Texas. You're here at the Urban League Convention here in Houston, your hometown. How's it been thus far?
Well, it's been good. I think that, in fact, I did an interview with the Urban League people backstage, and they asked me, they said, you know, why is it important that people be here? So if you're talking about your Urban League ecosystem, so this is the one place where folks are literally all gathered at the exact same time. So the ability to be able to listen to best practices, learn from one another, being able to glean from one another, I think is most important. Obviously, hearing from your critical newsmakers is another thing. But again, I think that's the other piece. Being able to sit down and say, okay, what are you doing? What are you doing? How can we learn from you? Then building from there. So that's what's important.
You pivoted from going network, TV One, now you have your own company. Why was it important for you to make that shift?
Well, actually, I didn't make the shift. That was always the mindset. So, for instance, when I joined CNN, folks don't realize I was with TV One before CNN. So how we often think, and I sort of call this white validation, a lot of people are like, ooh, now it's CNN, leave everything else behind. I was like, hell no. So CNN wanted me. CNN, literally, the president of CNN US, John Klein, 2009, asked me, went to lunch, and he said, when are you going to be done, you know, with TV One, Tom Jordan, all this other different stuff? And I said, when you give me a five-day-a-week show. Why did I ask that? Because the deal that I negotiated was a two-tier deal. It was a contributor deal and a show host deal. So I already knew what I was going to get paid to be a show host. And my response then was, then I'll think about it. I would have never left because I always understood they can say no, but if I control this, it's always a yes. And so even when I was doing Tom Joyner, when I was at TV One, people need to understand I wasn't full time. So therefore I was contract, which means that I was a vendor, they were a client. So that's where the concept of Me Inc. comes in. And so I always tell people, even if you're working within a company, you should not look at yourself as an employee, they are the employer. Look at yourself as the vendor, and they are the client. And then your job is to go get you other clients. So if any one client trips, then you just transition. Well, that's what happened. So in 2013, CNN doesn't want to renew my contract. I just simply transitioned. 2017, when TV One ends News One Now, I just transition. When Tom Joyner retires in the 2019, I just transitioned. So I was always thinking ahead, and then when I was even at TV One, I was buying my own equipment. And so same thing with CNN. I used the concept. I gave this to Sullivan O'Brien, some other people. I said, when you're working there, think of them as your personal venture capitalists, and they are setting up your next business. And so the problem for most people is they're working in these places and they think these jobs will never end. I start the job on day one already thinking it's going to end. So every place I was, so CNN, TV One, Tom Joyner Morning Show, going back to Chicago Defender, Dallas Weekly, going back to my first job, Austin American Statesman, my second job, Fort Worth Star-Telegram, that literally was the mindset. Always, because even in the places, even going back to Austin and Fort Worth, I bought my own stuff. So I own my own laptop. Had my own cell phone, had my own camera. So if anything happened to the job, I still had gear that I can then use to get paid. So that has to be the mindset. And what happens is the mistake that people make is they don't start thinking about this until the job ends. Well, now you're behind the eight ball because now you're trying to figure out how to pay bills, and now you don't have any equipment. So now you don't know what – you're like, okay, dang, what do I do? So I'm always trying to get people to understand that. So – And then it's also it's studying the business, studying where we're going. And so I was always 10 years ahead in terms of, okay, this is where we're going with digital. I remember I went to Columbia had they had a multimedia fellowship. It was called a convergence conference. They didn't have a name. It was called Media Convergence. And the reason it was hilarious conference because we didn't touch no equipment. It was all theoretical. But what was crazy, when they opened it, they said, okay, how many of you have worked in radio? And the radio people, hands went up, raised my hand. And they said, how many of you done television? TV hands went up, I raised my hand. They said, how many of you done newspaper? Newspaper hands went up. I was the only person in the room who had already done all three. So that was so what I'm trying to get people to understand is when you're now looking at the landscape, everybody kept thinking, oh my God, but the CNN is CNN, but the CNN, there's still limitations. So for me, I understood I built this following, I have this audience, I have a very loyal audience. Now, how do I now take this loyal audience and now fill a void, create an opportunity where even the black networks were not doing? And that's really what happened. But you have to also start with the viewpoint of people like, yeah, but that's CNN. You're not CNN. And I'm like, you're right, because CNN actually can't do what I do. So we're here at the Urban League. Is CNN here? No. Is CNBC here? ABC? Any of them? No, they're not. So I have absolutely complete access to all of the content here. Now I can come here, bank content for the show, run it for the next 2-3 days, and again, be able to understand the cost model. Last point, it's the business side. The greatest mistake of content people is they love the content, they'll know jack about the business of content. That's why most journalists, when they start ventures, they fail. Because they're like, oh my God, content is great. Yeah, but who's watching? Who's reading? And so that's the other piece, is you have to be a student of the business, because the whole point is to stay in business.
When you look at what you just articulated, why is it important for Roland Martin to have that voice, that black voice, to express the concerns and aspirations of our people?
Well, I'll give you a perfect example. So I'm at CNN. Winnie Mandela comes to Birmingham. And so they couldn't find nobody. Out of all the people at CNN, they couldn't find nobody who wanted to interview Winnie Mandela. I was like, are you serious? So they come to me. And I was like, yeah. So they fly me down to Birmingham, and was at a black church there. I think we had about 20 or 25 minutes. I sit down with Winnie Mandela. So then next week, I finished the interview. Police escort to the airport. I had to fly to a speech or something. Next week, I get a phone call. Hey, they said, well, why didn't you ask her this? I said, why in the hell y'all didn't talk to her? I asked her. Well, I wanted to ask her. So they had a problem that I didn't ask her something. And so then they said, well, you know, we're not going to run the interview. I said, all right. I went to John Klein. I said, yo, the Atlanta people are not going to run the Winnie Mandela interview. I need the tape. I'm going to run on my TV One show. John was like, fine. We go to D.C. because we were in New York. We go to D.C. Then we go to CNN Washington Bureau. They make a copy of the tape. We get the tape. We run on my TV One show. March 2018, Winnie Mandela becomes an ancestor. I'm in Memphis for the MLK 50th, getting ready for the commemoration, the 50th anniversary of King's assassination. I hit my guy. I said, yo, restream the interview. We still had the interview. So the only reason you can see the Winnie Mandela interview that I did today is because I had a black-owned platform and I had a show to run it. So white media, CNN, said we not going to run it because a white producer decided that I didn't ask about this, so therefore we're not going to run it. Fine. I now had another platform to run it. That's why. And so and I'm using another example. It's not involving me. Story just came out last year, 1979, ABC 2020, one of those shows. They did this whole interview with James Baldwin. A white producer said, who cares about some washed-up black writer? It never aired. It never aired. And the producer who worked on it was the one who made it public that said, this thing has been sitting, again, it's been sitting on a shelf for almost 30 years because some producer decided that James Baldwin was not important enough for ABC. That's why. And so for me, I When TV One show ended, people kept coming in. They're like, oh, man, I love you. Why are you going to MSNBC or CNN? This is exactly what I said. I said, I'm not asking some 32-year-old white producer, can I go talk to black people? And that's why. We cannot be in a position where we are having to go ask white journalists to go talk to important black people because they don't know who's important in our community. So they go, well, no one knows who that is, so we're not interested. I wasn't going to do that. And that's and that was a driving motivation. And I said, I'm not asking permission. The history of black people, we don't get here because we waited on them. And this, and I've been saying this for now for more than two decades. My greatest fear is that when it comes to black news, not entertainment, not sports, my greatest fear, and if you look at how we've just fallen, Ebony and Jet and even Essence, even going on, we're going to be asking white media, if we're not careful, to tell our story. Well, the problem is they will be deciding who is important to black people, and that, to me, is something that we should be definitely afraid of. And that even extends not just to who we cover, but even the voices that come through. Somebody asked me, they said, you know, what do you think is your greatest legacy? And they were surprised I said this. I said, the number of black people who have come through me who are now on other platforms. And they said, oh, no, I know. They named like three or four. I said, no, it's about 30 or 40. And they're like, are you serious? Because it took me 4.5 years to get hired at CNN. I knew all the traps. I knew why they wouldn't hire folk. So when I got my own show, Washington Watch on TV One, News One Now on TV One, Tom Jordan Morning Show, my segment on there, and now my own a show, I said, I'm going to use my platform, was all intentional, to highlight, elevate folk. 2016, CNN probably hired 7 of my regular panelists. And somebody came to me and said,
I saw that.
And somebody kept me. I'm talking about David Swerdlick,
right.
Paris Denard,
exactly.
Shermichael Singleton,
right.
Laura Coates,
yep.
Angela Rye, Nia Malika Henderson came through me with Washington Watch, and it was a couple others. It was like 6 or 8. And so somebody came to me and they said, man, they taking all your people. I said, bruh, chill. And I tweeted this. I said, Jeff Zucker, you can hire every black panelist I put on. I'm good. I'm going to go find a whole new crop. I said, MSNBC, y'all can hire every black panelist that comes through my show. I'm going to go hire another crop. Because the reality is the talent's out there. And I said, so people thought I was offended. I said, no. I said, I know they're watching. And those black people, had they not, and Laura Coates has come to me, and she's like, I will forever say thank you. Because Laura Coates did not first sit in an anchor chair at CNN. It was my chair at TV One. Shermichael Singleton, Republican, thanks me all the time. He said, bro, I don't have a TV career without you. And that's what people need to understand. And so it's not just my voice. It's the fact that I've controlled the product to create other opportunities. And so now there are more black voices. And that's the key.
I've seen you get upset over the decades. But the incident at Texas A&M with Dr. McElroy really ticked you to no end.
Yeah, it was personal. And it was personal because not only it was personal because, one, I'm a Texas A&M graduate. Two, I have a journalism degree at Texas A&M. With one, because I'm black. Two, I'm a Texas A&M graduate. Three, I'm a journalism graduate. But four, what they essentially were saying was, if y'all got a problem hiring her, y'all sure as hell would never hire me. And what it says is that you're black, you can come through here, you can graduate, and we love touting you, we love showcasing you, we love said, oh, they're one of ours. But then and all that, oh, we support Aggies, we got each other's back. But here y'all said, but no, you see, No. She was the New York Times, and she wants to focus on race and diversity and ethnicity. Yeah, we ain't down with that. So it's like, oh, so what y'all want is y'all want ghost-like Negroes. Yeah, y'all want black folk who ain't black. That's the game that they're playing, and that's what pissed me off. And I made it perfectly clear. I do not have my Texas A&M ring on. I made it clear until I see substantive changes, I will not put that ring on. Oh yeah, so I was inducted in the Texas A&M Journalism Ring of Honor, and that box, that plaque was on my set, right under the Harry Belafonte photo, and live on the air. I said, go take that off the set right now. I said, because they are not going to be deserving of that place if you have this kind of treatment. And see, the thing for me, for a lot of, and this is what I made clear to all of them down there. I said, I don't owe y'all nothing. I'm not asking y'all for a job. I ain't begging y'all for football game tickets. I could buy my own damn tickets. And see, the hardest thing for white America to deal with is a free black man. Because when you're a free black man and you don't owe them nothing and they ain't paying your bills and they not sustaining you, and when you have that level of freedom, then you become scary. And so I made it clear. I said, oh, so y'all love when I'm rocking the Texas A&M golf bag and a hat and shirt. And then when I'm throwing the gig'em and I'm coming to games, y'all love doing that. Y'all love see. Oh man, we saw you on ABC News this week, and we saw your Aggie ring, and you got your Texan lapel pin. See, they love that. And so my whole deal is, I'm the same brother. So if y'all love that rolling, well then this other role is the same brother. And see, that's what scares them, which is what they can't handle. What they can't handle is all of you. So what a lot of those white Aggies want, they just want that, they want the safe black graduate. Well, the reality is, oh, I'm the same one, and I made it perfectly clear. I use the example, when I was in Fort Worth, the publisher, Rich Connor, had hired this grossly unqualified white woman, Debbie Price, to be the executive editor over this ridiculously qualified brother, Ken Bunting. And so Connor calls a staff meeting, and I'm pissed. Mind you, shh, bruh, I ain't even 18 months out of college. I don't give a damn. That white woman had no business getting that job. She had never been an editor on any level in her career. My man had been city editor, state editor, assistant managing editor. I was like, hell no. So we had the meeting, and so it was time for questions. I'm drilling his ass. Folk like Ken looking at me like it'll be okay. I'm like, hell no. And people looking at me, they're like, yo, roll. And so it was so funny. So people were lining up shaking her hand. I walked right past her. I wasn't shaking her hand. And they were like, man, Doc, you went hard. I said, let me explain something to y'all. I said, when you get a pit bull, it's a pit bull. Now it might be your pit bull, but it's gonna be a pit bull at home and a pit bull away from home. I said, and sometimes your pit bull may come at you. I said, because it's a pit bull. I said, don't mistake a pit bull for a poodle. And they were just shocked that I was willing to go hard at the publisher. And I'm like, that's how I roll. I was not going to stand there and be a quiet Negro and watch that black man get passed over and say, well, you know, I got to look out for my job, so I ain't going to sit in and go hard. Nah, I can get another job. But it's the principle of it. And that, to me, at Texas A&M, is the principle of it. And I've made it clear to them, I'm going to use all 4 million followers to beat their ass down as much as I can and then let them know I will not be silent.
Talk to us about your current book, White Fear.
Oh, man. Here's a perfect example how white folk are scared. So, first of all, the concept of white fear, how the browning of America is making white folks lose their mind. I've been talking about that since 2009. There was a study that came out. It was right before Obama got inaugurated. I think it was Pete. And the question was asked, are you optimistic about the future of America for your children? Every racial group, black, Latino, Asian, Native American, all was majority of 50% or higher. There's only one group was less, white America. September 2016, the question was asked, are you optimistic about the future of America economically for the next 10 years? Black people, lowest wealth, highest optimism. Latinos, second lowest wealth, second highest optimism. Asians, number three in wealth, third highest. White America, highest wealth, lowest optimism. Cap Hughes has a phrase that says you got to be deeper than mustard on a hot dog. So when you see these things, you got to now ask, hold up, what's going on here? And so I've always talked about it on air, and I'm trying to explain to people that white folks are absolutely afraid of the future when America's going to become a nation majority of people of color. I said, because this is about power and money. And so when you look at everything, when you look at their fears, so they think we're getting more, or Obama's going to do more for them than us. And it was like, what the hell are y'all talking about? And so that's what's been driving them. But then when you study that, you take it even further back. It's always been white fear. At every juncture of black success, white folks feared that they were going to be losing and we were going to be taking from them. Well, first of all, let's just be fundamentally clear. Y'all can't have everything. So some of y'all are going to lose some stuff, meaning y'all can't get all the jobs if we're not coming to corporate America, because what they've never been able to handle is the competition. And so the problem, so I laid it all out, and every time something kept happening, I kept saying, y'all, white fear. We saw it with MAGA. We saw it over and over and over again. So this thing didn't start with Trump. So when I put the book together, then what was crazy, every time something kept happening, we kept adding something to it. I found it on the publisher. I was like, listen, white people going to keep acting a fool? I said, so we're going to publish this book sometime. And so when January 6th hit, I said, yo, we got to stop playing. That book was supposed to have been out in January of 2020. And it kept getting pushed, kept getting pushed. And finally, I was like, yo, we can't keep pushing it. And so that cover art is from January. I specifically wanted a January 6th photo. And you got a white man in the foreground, his arms are outstretched. What that symbolizes is all of this is ours. And that's really what they were saying. But let me tell you how, we'll tell you again, how white fear shows up in media, which I write about in the book. Again, I'm going back to these white producers. A number of white producers at stations in New York and networks, a publicist told me point blank as well, refused to book me. They didn't like the title.
Roland S. Martin, journalist, columnist, commentator, author, managing editor of Roland Martin Unfiltered, and founder of the Black Star Network. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at kut.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny O'Hanson Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, 300 West Dean Keaton Boulevard, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
Coming up next, we have our regular features here on Ebony Spectrum and some news clips for this week.
Y'all know the government almost shut down last week?
And we're not out of the woods yet. The
is a government shutdown. Number one,
a government shutdown happens when the legislative branch neglects to pass specific bills that fund or authorize the operations of the executive branch. So if Congress doesn't approve the funding for the federal government by the time the new fiscal year starts on October 1st every year, we could be in danger. What this means for the government is that certain operations will literally cease because ain't nobody getting paid and ain't nothing getting paid for. What that means for you is that, yes, Social Security and disability checks will still be paid out, but quite a few things in everyday life will be impacted. But before we get into any of that, let's talk about how the f*** we got here in the first place and why there is actually a looming threat of government shutdown almost every year. The short answer, the blues and the reds can't get along. The Republicans and the Democrats, not the bloods and the cribs. Moving along. So there are two different types of federal spending. Mandatory programs like Social Security, Medicare, and unemployment, and discretionary programs like national defense, public health research, national parks, international assistance, and infrastructure. Discretionary means you can fund if you want to, which is crazy to me, but here comes the partisan struggle. In most years since 2010, the two sides of Congress have not been able to come together on agreed upon budget. They had to figure out high-level taxes and spending targets and create bills to figure out exactly how much money goes into what areas. And when they can't agree, walk with me now, the president steps in and Congress enacts what is called a continuing resolution, or CR, for the discretionary programs, which means they will continue to operate at the last year's budget until they can figure everything out. But the one President Biden just signed only lasts 45 days. Ooh, child, I'm tired. Figure it out. These people need to get on their Zoom. And it's not even legitimate concerns about the money. They're in there on that House floor squabbling about government spending when eggs are damn near $10 and everybody under the age of 35 needs a roommate to survive out here. Each time the government shuts down, 350,000 government employees are furloughed without pay. The Environmental Protection Agency, the Departments of Agriculture, Commerce, Justice, Homeland Security, Interior, State, Treasury, and Housing and Urban Development will slow down. Over 400,000 government employees are forced to work without pay. That's legal? And this game of roulette hits home especially in our communities because you know black folk love them a government job. Benefits, healthcare, stability. Government jobs specifically at the USPS have been responsible for catapulting black people into the middle class since the 1800s. The USPS was one of the first government sectors to offer employment to newly freed people after slavery, which explains why every time your grandmama and them heard about somebody down their luck, they told you to go on down to the post office and get you a job. And even though black people only make up 13% of the country's population, we make up 20% of all government employees. Golly, always somewhere being adverse affected. But it makes sense that this many black people would flock to the public sector because it has definitely come a long way in closing the economic gap between white and black workers. In California, 72% of black government employees join a retirement plan versus the 44% in the private sector. But government essential workers would not be the only people affected. Transportation security officers, Coast Guard members, Bureau of Prisons employees, Veterans Affairs employees, that's my mama. And Border Patrol officers are all at risk. The Smithsonian's and national parks you go to are closed. Immigration courts closed. Airport delays increased. Construction on the road and infrastructure halted. Food inspections stalled. Gross. Your kids not going to Head Start. Funding for EBT and SNAP, provisions related to the pandemic and even AIDS relief, snip snip ho. And while all these essentials are in limbo, while people are being forced to keep the government running without pay, the congressmen and women who put us in this predicament will still be making money while actively slacking on a job. This, my friends, is why you gotta know exactly who you're voting for, who's gonna have your back in that room, and who's gonna waste your time. So we need to be getting on Ballotpedia, BallotReady.com, MyVoterPage.com, and see what these midterm elections is talking about.
This is the Black World Media Network, putting the global diaspora issues up front. Professor Ron Daniels is the president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. And this is From the Desk of the Professor.
David versus Goliath. No homeland, no peace. No justice, no peace in Israel. Free Palestine. I woke up Saturday morning to the shocking news that a coordinated massive surprise land, air, and sea attack launched by the political, military Palestinian political organization Hamas was shockingly delivering devastating and deadly blows against the vaunted Israeli Defense Forces, IDF, and tragically killing hundreds of civilians. A stunned Western world led by the U.S. reflexively rushed to pledge undying support and massive aid to Israel, one of the most powerful military states in the world, Goliath. While vociferously condemning Hamas, a leader of the marginalized, homeless, stateless people, David, completing the appropriate David and Goliath analogy, David, thereby ignoring, being oblivious to, and turning a blind eye to the anguish, aspirations, and anger of a brutally, ruthlessly oppressed people, the Palestinians. Let me say it loud and clear again. There will never be peace, tranquility, lasting calm in Israel until the Palestinians have a home, a state of their own. No amount of military force will quench the legitimate thirst of the Palestinian people for justice. no homeland, no peace. No justice, no peace. Hashtag Free Palestine.
That viewpoint was ripped from the desk of the professor, Ron Daniels. Listen daily for a view on a myriad of issues from the desk of the professor. This is the Black World Media Network. On the Black World Media Network, this is Book Bundle, a review of literary works in varying media formats. Here is the reviewer, Professor Todd Stephen Burroughs.
Boy, I got a lot to get to today, but first I wanted to wish everybody in America, I hope you had a very good banned book week. It was banned book week, and people were talking about how to fight against all these book bans that are happening all across America. It's really a horrible, horrible thing, and I'm glad to see so many people rising up, particularly LeVar Burton of Reading Rainbow fame. I'm really happy that he got involved. So I just wanted to wish everybody who fought the good fight this week, I hope you had a good and happy in quotes, banned book week. Today is Amiri Baraka's birthday. He would have been 89. He died in 2014. As a tribute to him, I wanted to read one of his poems. He did these series of poems called Wise Wise, W-I-S-E, W-H-Y-S. And so I wanted to read the first one, which is called Wise, W-H-Y-S, Nobody Knows the Trouble I've Seen, Traditional. If you ever find yourself somewhere lost and surrounded by enemies who won't let you speak in your own language, who destroy your statues and instruments, who ban your boom, ba-boom, then you are in trouble, deep trouble. They ban your boom, ba-boom, you in deep, deep trouble. Huh. Probably take you several hundred years to get out. That is, again, Wise Number One, a series of wise poems by Amiri Baraka, a son of Newark, New Jersey, as I am. So I'm very happy to claim this man, as basically many of us in Newark are, for sharing the same land, the same soil, and the same northern New Jersey Black nationalist culture that was influenced by Amiri Baraka, who was a major political leader as well as cultural leader, and the author of many, many, many books. Speaking of books, wanted to read a couple of news items. This is from Richard Prince's Journalism's column, and it involves one of the members of the Black World Media Network. Milton Alemani, the publisher of Black Star News and author of Manufacturing Hate, How Africa Was Demonized in Western Media, started a GoFundMe page to raise $3,000 because he said he wanted to buy back the copyright for his book. The company, for some reason, I think I can guess why, without even notifying me, stopped offering the printed version and is only selling digital. Prior to that, many people had complained that they would wait as long as 4 to 6 months after ordering the physical book via Amazon. My own publisher seems reluctant to have the book widely available. Given the subject matter, many friends have told me they're not surprised. Richard Prince points out that the book was excerpted in the Journalism's column in July 2021. Interesting item, you know, as we reflect on the banned book week that just passed. Now, let's talk about another Black writer that seems to be getting shut down. Now, this is from the Daily Beast. The author of a book on Jamal Khashoggi, the Saudi journalist who was murdered by Saudi agents at the country's consulate in Turkey, said the publisher HarperCollins had halted the editing process, forcing her to pull the book entirely. Karen Atta, his editor at the Washington Post and the book's author, made the announcement on Twitter after the newspaper published an excerpt from the work. Khashoggi had been targeted due to the regime's zero-tolerance policy on political dissent. Before his murder, he had reportedly planned to establish an outlet focusing on counter-propaganda against the country. Atta's work, entitled Say Your Word, Then Leave, The Assassination of Jamal Khashoggi and the Power of the Truth, is still listed as a HarperCollins book on sources such as Amazon, but a spokesman for the company said it was no longer the publisher. Atta is an African/American from African ancestry, direct African ancestry, is a Black American as well as an African immigrant, and is a major part of the Washington Post. So that's a very fascinating story because I've never heard of the editing process halting and then people stopping like that. Or to be more honest, I've rarely heard about it. But when it comes to Black authors, you know, it's not hard to believe the problems that we go through. I talked about book banning week. I wanted to read this headline from Democracy Now. School book bans surged 33% over prior year, with Florida leading the charge. A new report from PEN America finds a 33% spike in the number of public school book bans during the 2022-2023 school year compared to the prior year. The report finds 40% of recent book bans occurred in Florida, where Governor Ron DeSantis and Republican lawmakers have imposed mass restrictions on books about race and LGBTQ plus issues in school libraries and classrooms. Finally, I just want to point out a couple of articles dealing with the fight over banned books. One is from the Smithsonian. The headline is called A Brief History of Banned Books in America. Attempts to resurrect what kids in school can read are on the rise, but American book banning started with the Puritans 140 years before the United States. And you can find that online at SmithsonianMag.com. Another article I want to point out is about Black resistance to book banning. An article called Black Churches in Florida Buck DeSantis, Trying and Failing to Go to Trump's Right Flank. And the headline is, some Black churches in Florida are stepping up to teach Black history, saying the state has watered-down versions taught to students. Florida has been a battleground for teachings about race. And you can reach that article at usatoday.com. And that's it for quite a packed Black book bundle. I'm going to go back to doing book reviews starting next week. We will discuss the book, A Day in the Life of Abed Salama, Autonomy of a Jerusalem Tragedy, written by Nathan Thrall. This is an outgrowth of a huge article that he did for the New York Review of Books talking about Israeli apartheid against the Palestinians.
That was Book Bundle, a review of literary works in varying media formats, presented by reviewer Professor Todd Stephen Burroughs, journalist, historian, and popular culture enthusiast.
The DeSantis administration is now scouring social studies books for prohibited topics.
Members of the public reportedly applauded after one woman said, if they insist on having the books and if we don't win again, then just close down.
This isn't for 8-year-old kids. This is for kids who are 12 or 13 or 14 who might actually be struggling with stuff. And reading this material, hearing about yourself in a book, can actually save lives.
It is officially banned books week, and it could not come at a more crucial time for our nation. All across the country, calls to ban books with topics addressing sex, gender, and race are growing even louder. According to the American Library Association, so far this year, there have been nearly 700 attempts to ban or restrict library materials and services, and nearly 4,000 titles targeted in that same time for censorship. Well, I am most honored to have the one and only LeVar Burton here with me tonight. He has had an extraordinary career in the arts, but many of us know him best as the host of the iconic and beloved PBS program, The Reading Rainbow. And he is this year's honorary chair of Banned Books Week. LeVar, I'm holding myself back from singing the Reading Rainbow theme song only because this is such a serious topic. How worried are you by these numbers?
Well, the one statistic that you didn't mention was that these numbers are up over 20% than last year. It is alarming. It's concerning. But we are having a conversation in this country about a lot of things, about around who we want to be as a nation. And this is as important as it gets.
So do you see this as a silver lining, right? Because we're talking, because we're fighting back, waking up to these book bans, do you see it as a net positive that the hatred isn't sort of under the surface? It's out there, and it's out there for people to fight back against.
Absolutely. And I think that's a positive thing. Look, every book is not for everybody, Steph, but I believe that there is a book for everyone, right? And as a parent, I believe that you should have the right to monitor and have a say in what your child consumes in terms of literature and media. But what you don't have the right to do is impose your beliefs about your children on everybody else's kids. And censorship is just not okay. So we have to have a no-nonsense conversation that involves common sense. And when people say that there are no books being banned, then they're just ill-informed or being willfully ignorant. And I hear all the time on my social media that I'm a pedophile because I I want kids to have access to books. If you're reading literature about racism, bigotry, violence, sexual assault, murder, suicide, kids will have a vocabulary to deal with these situations. And what the other side, the rhetoric that they're engaging in, fails to recognize the belief that age appropriateness is first and foremost the thing that we have to be mindful of. Like I said, every book is not for everybody, but every book, there's somebody that is destined to read it.
You very famously played a very important role, a slave in Roots. In this climate, today, especially in places like Florida, would Roots even be nationally televised?
There would be resistance to it, but again, it's a story that needs to stay alive in this culture. There's a lot of retrenchment going on, I don't need to tell you, Stephanie, in this country, especially around the issue of history and how it's being taught and who it's being taught to, and those who are trying to further the efforts to not teach the real history of the United States. We have a real serious problem in this country owning up to who we are and how we got here. And we are doing our children a great disservice by censoring the very material they need to be learning so that they can make informed decisions about who they want to be in this society.
Saturday is Let Freedom Read Day, where people are asked to take one action to defend books from censorship. What could that look like?
Right.
What do you want people to do?
Support your teachers, your school librarian, publishers, writers, readers. We all have a stake in this fight, in this conversation. No one is immune. We all need to wake up, pay attention, and recognize that there are people who are trying to really take away our right to read. This is not okay, not in the America I know and love. And so we are celebrating banned books. Read the banned books, I like to say. That's where the good stuff is.
Well, LeVar, it is up to us to lead an America that we want to live in. And every day we have a chance to do just that. LeVar, it is an absolute honor and a privilege to meet you. It's a dream of mine. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
On November 2, 1917, Britain's Foreign Secretary, Arthur Balfour, wrote a letter that would set off a conflict still being fought more than 100 years later.
His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object.
When Balfour wrote of his government's intent to create a Jewish homeland in Palestine, 90% of the people living there were not Jewish. Just 31 years later, most of them were gone. This is the story of the British promise that led to the destruction of Palestine and the creation of the State of Israel. Let's start with the obvious question. Why were the British making promises about other people's countries? The short answer, empire is one hell of a drug. This was World War I, and the British were making lots of promises. In addition to promising a Jewish homeland in Palestine, they promised Arab leaders independence if they rose up against Britain's enemy, the Ottoman Empire. The Arabs did. Hollywood even made a movie about it.
Arabia's for the Arabs now. That's what I've told them anyway. That's what they think. That's why they're fighting.
Oh, surely.
A month after Balfour's letter, British troops took Palestine, ending 400 years of Ottoman rule. The people who lived there were Arabs, mostly Muslims, but there were Christian and Jewish minorities too. There was also a tiny number of European Jews who in the late 1800s had started building small colonies there. At a time when many Jews were suffering horrific persecution in Europe, they felt Palestine could be an escape. The idea of building up a Jewish presence in Palestine became known as Zionism, but it stayed a fringe movement among European Jews. Many of them felt they shouldn't have to leave their countries to avoid persecution. But Zionism as a political movement took a big step forward with an Austrian man called Theodor Herzl. And this guy is a very important name in this story. In 1896, he published Der Judenstaat, or in English, The Jewish State. In it, he said the only way for Jews to avoid Europe's anti-Semitism was not just to leave, but to have their own country. And Herzl didn't just write. The next year, he organized a conference in Basel, Switzerland, the first Zionist Congress. The attendees agreed on a program which sought, among other things, to establish a Jewish homeland in Palestine and promote Jewish settlement in Palestine. From here on out, the Zionist movement became very active, setting up funds to promote Jewish immigration to Palestine, companies to buy land there, and recruiting representatives to advocate for their cause with different governments. A few days after the conference, Herzl wrote this in his diary.
At Basel, I founded the Jewish state. In 5 years, perhaps, and certainly in 50 years, everyone will perceive it.
He was only off by 1 year. Okay, so that is a lot of history, but it's important because the Zionist movement is a critical part of the story going forward. Especially after it found a friend in the British government, where a lot of high-ranking officials supported Zionism, sometimes for unexpected reasons. Prime Minister Lloyd George, for example, was a Christian zealot who believed gathering the Jewish people in Palestine would bring Jesus Christ back to earth. Others, like Balfour, believed that getting the Jewish people out of Europe and into their own country would be a good thing. Herzl was pretty visionary when he wrote that the anti-Semitic nations will become our allies. Meanwhile, the Zionists assured Britain that their future country would be a reliable ally. So that's the backstory of how European anti-Semitism, Zionism, and British imperialism all led to the Balfour Declaration, this British promise to build a homeland for Jews in Palestine. Now we're going to look at how Britain did that. World War I had been a conflict between rival empires, and the winners set up the League of Nations to distribute the losing side's territories between them. They called it the Mandate System, putting territories once controlled by the Ottoman and German empires under the, quote, tutelage of advanced nations until they became independent. Britain was given the mandate over Palestine, but the Palestinian people were never asked what they wanted or what independence would look like to them. Listen to what Balfour wrote to one of his colleagues.
For in Palestine, we do not propose even to go through the form of consulting the wishes of the present inhabitants of the country.
Instead, it was the Zionists who were consulted about what their vision for Palestine was, and so the mandate ended up incorporating not just the Balfour Declaration, but several clauses requiring Britain to ensure the establishment of a Jewish home in Palestine. British rule was very accommodating to the Zionist project. The Jewish community in Palestine grew with big waves of immigration. They had their own schools and factories and even their own militia, the Haganah. And they were led by the Polish-born David Ben-Gurion, the leader of their representative body, the Jewish Agency. To the Palestinians, it was clear that Britain wasn't delivering them independence. It was delivering their country to other people. In 1936, they went on strike. British forces tried to break the strike with arrests, torture, mass punishment, and executions. Leaders were exiled, weapons confiscated, and houses blown up. Palestinian fighters attacked British and Jewish targets, while British and Haganah forces would carry out joint raids on Palestinian villages. Something had to change. The British government sent a commission called the Peel Commission to figure it out, but their proposed solution was typical. Just draw another British line on the map, divide the country, give this part to the Jews and this part to the Palestinians, and make that part of Transjordan next door. Oh, and because the Palestinians were a majority in the country, 250,000 of them would have to be removed by force to make the Jewish state viable. Remember, these were the proposals that were meant to calm things down. Spoiler, they didn't. Instead, the revolt continued until 1939, by which time about 10% of Palestine's adult male population had either been killed, injured, arrested, or exiled. The British government really needed a solution. So here comes another report.
The commission is studying the 20-year-old Jewish settlements in British-mandated Palestine.
The 1939 White Paper created a conflict between the British and the Zionists for the first time, because it rejected partition and said the solution was for Palestine to gain independence within 10 years, with everyone living there sharing it together. Crucially, it also imposed severe limits on Jewish land purchases and immigration. To the Zionists, this felt like a betrayal. In response, some set off bombs across the country, killing dozens of Palestinians. But soon, everyone was distracted by something much bigger. More than 60 million people were killed in World War II, including 6 million Jews murdered in Nazi death camps. Jewish survivors fled Europe, with a large number of them trying to find safety in Palestine despite the British limit on Jewish immigration. This set off a more direct confrontation between the Zionists and the British, with Palestinians often targeted as well. The Zionists knew two things. Militarily, they were stronger than the Palestinians, and Britain was exhausted by World War II, so it wouldn't have the stomach to keep fighting in Palestine. They were right. In 1947, after 30 years of occupation, Britain announced it was quitting Palestine and asked the newly formed United Nations to clean up its mess. Alright, 1947 and 1948 are the most pivotal years in this story, so let's take a look at how things are lining up. During British rule, Jews had gone from 10% to 30% of the population, and owned about 6% of the land. Under Ben-Gurion's leadership, the Jewish Agency was pretty much functioning as a government for the Jewish community. And the Zionist militias had tens of thousands of soldiers, modern weapons, and officers who'd already fought in World War II. On the other side, the Palestinians hadn't been allowed to develop their own administration or military. But as they waited for the UN solution, they were still the majority all over the country. In November 1947, the UN, then only made up of a fraction of the world's countries, voted to partition Palestine. This plan marked off 55% of the country for a Jewish state. But the UN never explained how it could be a Jewish state when half the people in its territory were Palestinian. To nobody's surprise, Palestinians, and in fact all Arabs, rejected the UN's plan. Ben-Gurion and the Zionist leadership accepted, but they saw an opportunity. With the British on the way out, the Zionists knew they would have the strongest military in Palestine. Their forces were instructed to seize more territory than they'd been awarded by the UN, and to do what was necessary to reduce the number of Palestinians in it. In cities like Haifa, the militia set off car bombs in Palestinian neighborhoods. They attacked villages and forced residents out.
Haganah troops have driven the Arabs out of the beleaguered city, taking many prisoners.
After inspecting parts of Western Jerusalem that had been emptied of Palestinians, Ben-Gurion said,
"In many Arab neighborhoods in the West, you do not see even one Arab. If we persist, it is quite possible that in the next 6 or 8 months, there will be considerable changes in the country, and to our advantage."
One of the events that helped speed up these changes took place on April 9th, 1948, when the village of Deir Yassin was attacked. A British government report to the United Nations describes the scene. 250 people were killed in circumstances of great savagery. Women and children were stripped, lined up, photographed, and then slaughtered by automatic firing. The story of what happened at Deir Yassin set off panic all over the country. As news spread, people fled, fearing they would be next. Historians have recorded dozens of similar massacres during this period. Each time, they would result in entire communities fleeing. By the time Britain ended its mandate on May 15th, 1948, 250,000 Palestinians had fled. The night before, David Ben-Gurion announced the founding of the State of Israel, with himself as its first prime minister. He was standing under a giant portrait of Herzl, 51 years after Herzl had predicted this very moment. The Zionist militias came together as the newly formed Israel Defense Forces, but the fighting wasn't over. With the British out of the way, soldiers from several Arab countries entered Palestine. But the Israeli army was better equipped, better organized, and unlike the Arab armies, had a unified command and backing from several European countries. Israeli forces pushed into places that the UN had assigned to the Palestinian state, like the towns of Lidda and Ramle. 50,000 people were forced to flee from there, many on foot, in what became known as the Lidda Death March. After being emptied, the towns were given Hebrew names, Lod and Ramla. Like in many other empty towns, the buildings and homes were taken over by the new Israeli state and given to Jews. By the time the UN secured an armistice, 3/4 of the Palestinian people had become refugees.